Egypt Month would not be complete without a visit with Dr. Robert Schock. Robert Schock's known for his geological survey and redating of the Great Sphinx to a significantly older period, in his own words, to the Zip-Tepi period of 10,500 years ago. And we'll talk about his work with John Anthony West, who recently passed, and their conflicts with the Egyptological organizations that oversee the Great Sphinx, the pyramids, and the Giza Plateau. We'll also discuss with Dr. Schock this new discovery of a unknown chamber in the upper quadrant of the Cheops Pyramid in Egypt. This is a very important discovery that for some reason the Egyptologists find is unnecessary. So we'll also speak with our media critic, Adam Young. He has a number of wonderful suggestions for reading and for viewing, referencing our guest today. So we packed a lot into today's show. And as always, you're in for a bit of a ride. All this and the news today on Earth Ancients. For Saturday, February 24th, 2018, this is Earth Ancients. I'm your host, Cliff Dunning. Hello, how you doing? It's still winter. It's supposed to be coming up on spring here, but it is winter. I'm freezing today out here in Northern California. I'm sure those of you listening are probably in like sub-zero temperature going, dude, what's your problem? I mean, I'm uncomfortable at 40 degrees, 42 degrees, but I bet a lot of other people are much colder. So, hey, welcome to Earth Ancients. This is shaping up to be quite an interesting year for Earth Ancients. We are crossing over to a lot of mainstream science, and I just got confirmation of the TV scientist. He's a theoretical physicist, Dr. Michio Kaku, who just wrote a new book called The Future of Humanity, which I'm listening to, and he is going to be a special addition to the program in March and will be part of our new Patreon program that I'm going to talk about here in a minute. But not only Dr. Kaku, but the eminent authority on consciousness and specifically consciousness expansion, Stephen Gray, is a special guest. He wrote a book that I just finished called Cannabis and Spirituality. And this is something I've been wanting to have on the program for a while. He talks about the shamanic use of cannabis, but not only the shamanic use, we've discovered that mummies have cannabis attached to them. They have cannabis in their skin, in their organs. Shows that it was used thousands and thousands and thousands of years ago. And Stephen's going to talk to us about his new research into just how important it is to add medicine plants to our practice. Now, this is not an endorsement to go out and get high all the time. And we don't even talk about it. It's actually more about raising of consciousness, how we evolve as a species. And it's really weird. You remember when we had Dr. Chandra Wickramsey's on the program and how he talks about the planet being seeded by off-world beings? I think, and I think Stephen does also, that this plant was provided to us to help raise consciousness, to help evolve humankind through these ceremonies when you use these sacred plants. And he talks a little bit about ayahuasca too. This discussion is important for us here in Earth Ancients because we're all about becoming aware. We're all about seeing the evolution. where we've been, where we're at, and where we're going. So very, very timely material, and I'm really looking forward to this presentation. But there's many, many, many more individuals to bring on board who will be talking about not only the ancient past, but what the ancients left us in the form of ritual, in the form of sacred plants, in the form of understanding consciousness that is coming to light right now. And this all takes work to bring these individuals on. It takes work to produce the show each week. And I've produced it and delivered it to a listening audience, to you, the listening audience, for 4 years, and I haven't asked anything from you. I need your help. I need your help in supporting Earth Ancients. If you're enjoying what you're getting, if you're enjoying the program each week, if you're getting something out of it, I would appreciate you supporting the show and giving me a couple of bucks every month. I have launched a Patreon page, and a Patreon is a website that allows me to take your sponsor's support, and I have different levels. I just posted this. You can see it on patreon.com/earthancients. It's patreon.com/earthancients. And I'm offering tiers, and for $3 a month, you will become a friend of Earth Ancients, or friends of Earth Ancients. And this is a chance to support the program with a small contribution. $3 a month? That's nothing. But if you can go up a little more, a patron of Earth Ancients, you will get these bonus interviews. For $5 a month, I will send you a bonus interview each month. And a lot of these I can't really put on the regular show because there's some of them are pretty interesting, and I say that lightly. But you'll get these additional interviews, and you'll also get a monthly newsletter. For $5 a month, you'll get a killer newsletter with all kinds of new content and other material and links to some of the material that Adam Young, our media critic, presents each week. We also have two other levels. If you're an Earth Ancients Explorer, which is $10 a month, you get everything I just talked about. Plus, you get Cliff Notes. And these are Cliff Notes. These are my ideas for the month, my research, my points of view. And part of it's an article that I will send just to the people who are the Explorer level, Earth Ancients Explorer. Now, I'm adding even more to that. For $10 a month, I'm sending everybody a private video on the month's news, on information, on my perspective, and adding some also highlights from other interviews I've done, and I'm kind of editing that all together. That's $10 a month, Earth Ancient Explorer. And then the final level, which is the Earth Ancients Visionary, for anyone who gives me $25 or more, you get everything I just talked about. You get the bonus interviews. You get the monthly newsletter. You get the Cliff Notes. You get the video. We'll be doing a monthly teleconference with myself and a special guest. So if you can put down $25 a month, you are really helping me out. And these teleseminars are private. They'll be recorded, so you'll be able to keep them and have them with you forever. And you will be able to ask questions of myself and one of my guests, whoever the guest is that month. And those are always fun. I have a number of clients that we use to do teleseminars every month, and those are lots of fun. So those are the tiers. $3, $5, $10, $25. If you can afford $3 a month, that's great. If you can afford $5, then you're getting into some really good stuff. And then the Explorer level of $10, you get that video, you get lots of stuff. So check it out. this allows me and my small growing crew to produce each podcast and give you more, because we're trying to grow the show. We're trying to take on more mainstream material. And also, we have another podcast in the mix that we need to launch. So I can't do it without you. I'm at a point now where I really need support. And so support me. Support Earth Ancients. You're here. You like it. You know you do. Patreon.com/Earth Ancients. I want to mention that March is Ancient America Month, and we have a stellar lineup. Scott Walter from the History Channel's Unearthed America will be one of our featured presenters. He's got some brand new material that he will present. We'll have Frank Joseph, one of the writers and editors for Ancient America magazine. He will be kicking things off next week. And we have a new author, Paul Devereaux, who has written a book called Mysteries of Ancient America. And he is an English author and research investigator who has uncovered some quite shocking material that is being suppressed. And he will be our guest on the third week. And then we have a special end of the month guest. You can imagine who it might be, or perhaps you can't. It's going to be somebody who is phenomenal, and I promise you will dig it. So again, March is Ancient America Month, and I hope you'll stop by and check it out.
Of all the boys I've known, and I've known some.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
Coming to you live from around the world, it's Earth Ancient News.
As always, there's a tremendous amount going on around the world as it relates to Earth Ancients. I know I really enjoy your contributions, those of you who send in videos, photo galleries. For the most part, we get really, really good material from you out there. Jonathan is a member who sent in a great video of Puma Punku in Bolivia. He is actually showing us in this short video a great vantage point of these massive stones. The video is a couple of minutes, but it's fabulous. And Jonathan, I want to thank you for sending that. He was just there a couple of days ago. Pumapunku is a weird place because no one can explain it. It has these advanced systems of some kind of cutting tool that cut these stones. And we're talking stones that weigh 50 to 100 tons in many cases. So great, great video. Thank you. I submitted a photograph for Copan. This is the hieroglyphic staircase. We'll be in Copan sometime between June 14th and the 25th. Copan is in Honduras. The hieroglyphic staircase is quite fabulous. It's made up of stone, carved stone with various symbols on it, and it leads up about, I think it's about a 75-foot mini pyramid with a gigantic figure in front. By the way, you can read all about this upcoming tour to Guatemala called Secrets of Guatemala by going to earthancients.com/tours. So that's a photo that I someone sent me, I put up. It's quite interesting. We have a photo archive from Marcus, who has submitted quite an interesting question that we have. It's called Advanced Cutting Tech in Ancient Egypt, and it's of this one gigantic blue stone that has been cut with some kind of machinery. There's even a picture of our good friend Zahi Hawass. I say that with tongue in cheek, who's standing in front of this stone. There's a short article about the thoughts behind its creation, and you can see that. Also, I posted a photo from Jim Vieira, who submitted a giant, it's called the Grand Menhir of Brittany, France. It's a 70-foot tall sphere. It's what it looked like when it was in one piece. It's broken into like three pieces, but he submitted this earlier in the week, and when you see it put together, it is monstrous, monstrous. And how they put it together and got it to stand up is quite fascinating. Andrew Collins has submitted a series of photos on Göbekli Tepe, and Göbekli Tepe now has a massive, massive roof on it that covers one of the main enclosures. They keep working on it. They're finding new burials and new information on it. This is pretty interesting. Fragments from a Nubian king have been found in northern Sudan. And this was an African king. He lived about 2,600 years ago. Part of his palace is there. They found a sculpture, and there's something very odd about the sculpture when you look at it. It's got two massive snakes on the forehead, and typically they're smaller than this. So the snakes were perhaps much more significant to this dynastic, pre-dynastic king. Petroglyphs have been found in central Chile that shows hunters of whales with big harpoons. This is a brand new petroglyph that's been discovered, and it shows that the water was much closer than what it was thousands of years ago. They don't have quite a date for that. And also, we have a nice gallery from Stephen Mailer, who is now in Egypt. He has sent back a series of photographs of some of the stonework that they have recently uncovered. And some of these columns and wall stones are monstrous, monstrous in size. And he writes in his article that he suspects that this is a megalithic culture, which is pre-dynastic. So you can see all this and more. We post every single day to the Facebook page, Facebook Earth Ancients. Go to the group or international page. Much of it is also found on earthancients.com. We're at the end of the month, the end of Egypt, all things Egypt, and we want to check in with our media critic, Adam Young, to see what he suggests for us as we conclude ancient Egypt, ancient pre-dynastic Middle East. Adam, how are you doing?
Good, Cliff. How are you?
I'm good. So what do you got for us today? We got Robert Schock. Who's written a number of books. Who do you suggest, what books do you suggest from his collection?
Yeah, so he's got a number that are great. I picked out two of them today. One of them's called Voyages of the Pyramid Builders. He wrote this back in 04.
Okay.
And he's got a few more recent ones, but I like this because he draws some pretty good relationships between Egypt, Sumeria, China, Peru, and he kind of shows how the same people that built pyramids in Egypt seem to have transferred their knowledge or maybe physically traveled around the entire world. And he says that, you know, the pyramids themselves are really, in his opinion, bridges to the heavens, either metaphorically or actually physically, and really represent a monument to human creativity. And Schock is, you know, a very conventional geologist. So coming from him, I think it really carries a lot of weight. And He wrote this book about 13 years ago, and then he followed it up with a newer one that was just released this past year called Origins of the Sphinx. And he did this with Robert Bivol, who, as I'm sure a lot of your listeners know, has talked about the Orion correlations with the pyramids and other celestial sort of representations. So the latest book talks a lot about how Schock has since revised his timeline. Originally, he was on the record saying he thought the Sphinx was 7,000 BC. He has now revised it to 10,000 BC before the flood. And, you know, it's interesting to see how traditional scientists and archaeologists have, you know, been pushing back their dates. So it's a great book. It also discusses Eftepi, which is mentioned by Graham Hancock as being the first time that Egypt sort of went through this cultural renaissance. And it talks about the Edfu building texts, which are interesting. Now, I just wanted to note that Buval's take on this is a little bit different than some other people's. In particular, Hakim Awyan, who said that the pyramids were not necessarily related to Orion. They were more of the Fibonacci sequence, and there was originally more of them. So there are a little bit of differences here and there, but it's all good. It's all interesting to me.
Yeah, Origins of the Sphinx I have in my library, and it's a large volume. Schock actually adds a lot of his own earlier papers to it.
Yeah.
And it's what makes it so big is that there's the original papers from both Buval and Schock. So that's a really good reference. Okay, so what do you got for us on video? What's happening on video?
A couple of YouTube documentaries. So both of these you can see for free on YouTube. The first one features Schock, but it's about the mysterious stone monuments of Marcahuasi. And it started with a Peruvian researcher by the name of Russo, who came across photographs of these giant monuments on the top of a flattened mountain in Peru called Marcahuasi. Mm-hmm. And they're, whatever your take on it is, I would say it's kind of impossible to ignore the statistical evidence, which is that there's 100 of these things that bear resemblance to human forms and animal forms, many of them from around the world that don't exist in South America. If they are indeed very ancient, they are extremely weathered. So what you're looking at is really a more of an abstraction than a realistic monument. But anyway, this documentary was made and it features Robert Schock, who was brought on board to kind of give a geological perspective on how old these might be. Well, are they man-made? Are we just imagining this? And it's a pretty interesting documentary. It talks about how the culture that may have built this was actually mentioned in the Bible. It was mentioned by the Romans. They acknowledged that there was an ancient culture, and they called it the Masma or Masma. So it's a great documentary. It's about an hour and 20 minutes. So I would recommend that.
Okay.
And the last one for today is a bit of a departure from Schock, but along the lines of true scientists or engineers, is something from Chris Dunn with David Hatcher Childress, who, for those of you who don't know David Hatcher Childress, he's like my favorite persona in this entire field. He's a really interesting guy to listen to. He's an excellent narrator. And he made a series of documentaries. This one's called Ancient Advanced Technologies, and it focuses on Egypt. He brings in Christopher Dunn, who's a British engineer and architect, and he lends a really good perspective from a stone mason or a stone engineering point of view. So he will look at the radius, the curvature, the precision, and relate that back to how something might have been made. Can you have carved something with a copper chisel, or did you have to have something more advanced? So this is a great documentary. I've seen this like 10 times. And it never gets old, even though it is old and dated at this point. But if you haven't seen this, it's really interesting reading, especially on a Sunday morning.
Cool. All right. So I'm going to post these on the Facebook page, which will automatically link to the earthancients.com. These are all great suggestions. That concludes our Egypt month. Adam, as always, excellent. And we'll talk to you next time.
All right. Thank you, Cliff.
This interview is brought to you by Vital Transport. Vital Transport is Earth Ancient's official travel agency for touring around the world. Our upcoming tour is Secrets of Guatemala. This is a June 15th through 24th tour. We'll be going to Tikal, Copan, Quirigua. This is an amazing tour simply because we have special access, special permits to climb pyramids, to climb unique buildings that are off limits to the general public. For more information, go to earthancients.com/tours. This is not to be missed. We only have a few spots left. Give us a call if you want. Toll free, 844-368-4825. That's 844-368-4825. Secrets of Guatemala. Come out and join me. So as we conclude Egypt month, we look to the experts, the people who are breaking the new ground. And we are real fortunate today to have Dr. Robert Schock with us. For those of you who are not familiar with his work, he is a tenured faculty member of Boston University. He earned a doctorate in geology and geophysics at Yale. He's best known for a number of books. He wrote a great book that we had. He was on the show a couple of years ago for Forgotten Civilization. Of course, his other book is Origins of the Sphinx, which he co-wrote with Robert Laval. And he's written a number of very, very good books on the topic of ancient civilizations and the Sphinx that are very important. So, hey, Robert, I'm glad you could join us today. How are you?
Oh, very good. Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
You know, I want to open up the program. I was real saddened to hear the passing of John Anthony West. I'd known John for 25 years, and I know his death affected you a great deal. Can you talk for just a moment about John's contributions to our understanding of the ancient past, specifically the Great Sphinx and the potential people who might have created it?
Yes. Well, it is very sad. I knew him for three decades, basically. He was the one who first got me involved in the issue of the Great Sphinx specifically. I have to say I was always interested in ancient civilizations, that type of thing. But he contacted me in the late 1980s. I was at that time at Boston University, where I still am full-time. He contacted me through some colleagues. He came to Boston University, gave a seminar, gave a presentation. I was in the audience. Little did I know at the time that it was actually given for my benefit, in the sense that he had wanted to meet me, that type of thing. So it was arranged that we had dinner afterwards. Again, this is the late 1980s. And something about John Anthony West everyone should know is that he got into Egypt and ancient civilizations sort of in a circuitous roundabout way. He started out really as a satirist, doing satire. He wrote short stories. He wrote plays. He wrote a novel called Osborne's Army. And he became interested in a roundabout way, if you would, in ancient civilization. And something that he felt very strongly was that modern civilization has real problems, it has real deficiencies, it has real setbacks, shall we say, not in terms of technology. What he was really talking about was philosophy and spirituality. And he had a very strong belief that ancient civilizations, and Egypt in particular, could shed light for us, could help enlighten us, if you would, and we could learn something from the wisdom that they had. And this got him involved in the work of someone known as Schwaller de Lubitsch, R.A. Schwaller de Lubitsch, and the Symbolist School of Egypt, which essentially says, in a nutshell, that the ancient Egyptians were not a bunch of primitives who had gods with human bodies and animal heads, that type of thing. But in fact, they were incredibly sophisticated, that they knew a lot, more than standard archaeologists, historians, and Egyptologists in particular give them credit for, that this was encoded in symbols, if you would, encoded not just in the hieroglyphics, but in the architecture that has remained in the, if you want to call it mythology, that type of thing. So he was very much of the belief, and I agree with him at this point, based on the evidence, that these civilizations were much more sophisticated than they're generally given credit for, and furthermore, that they go back to a much more remote period. And this is where the Sphinx comes in. And Schwaller had first noticed, and he just mentioned it in passing, that it looked like the Sphinx was eroded by water, not by wind and sand. And that's where I came in, because John Anthony West immediately realized that this was a geological problem. This was a geological question, not an Egyptological or archaeological question. So he was looking for a, quote, open-minded geologist, unquote, as he himself said. That's why he wanted to meet me, because he and I had a mutual colleague before John Anthony West and I knew each other. That colleague had been in Cairo teaching at, I believe, the American University in Cairo. He was a rhetoric professor, English literature professor. He came to Boston University, met me, and sort of had in the back of his mind, oh, you know, here's a geologist. Here's someone that might be able to help with this problem of the age of the Sphinx. So that's where it all began. And it was first in 1990, a long time ago now, it seems, that John Anthony West and I went together, traveled to Egypt, and that first trip was specifically to study the Sphinx. He and I traveled to Egypt many other times. I, of course, have been there many times. He was there many times. But that's the beginning of the story.
So let's, I mean, what was it that, I mean, obviously he showed you the weathering, and his belief that this was a much older sculpture. You had to take a huge risk as an academic to say, you know, John, I agree with you. I see what you're saying, and I am going to join with you. I mean, when did that? I mean, that's a huge.
It was a huge risk. And in answer to your question, that really occurred initially in 1990-1991, because we then presented to the Geological Society of America, I believe it was, this is off the top of my head, late 91, we had a, quote, debate on the age of the Sphinx at the American Association for the American Association for the Advancement of Science in early 92, and we did The Mystery of the Sphinx, the NBC documentary in 1993. So it actually happened relatively quickly from my perspective. For John Anthony West, it was taking much too long, because I insisted that we needed to collect a lot of data. We made several trips back and forth to Egypt in those early days. We got Dr. Thomas DeBecky, a geophysicist, involved, because I wanted subsurface data, so we did seismic work. We did a lot of work. John Anthony West is incredibly frustrated after the first trip, because he could see, and I was talking to him, but trying to couch my terms as much as possible, that, yeah, there was something here, there was some issue, but I kept looking for what was I missing, what stupid mistake was I making, why had the Egyptologist missed this, and I wasn't about to stick my neck out until I was absolutely certain, you know, as to what was going on.
Interesting.
So,
So
a lot of people don't realize
it. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, a lot of people don't realize that West was very, very frustrated with me on, I'll say, the first couple of trips, because he knew I discussed it with him. I said, yeah, there's these anomalies, there's weird things going on here, but, you know, I have to look at all the possible explanations. What might I be missing as a geologist? And how could the Egyptologists have missed this for so long if there really was an anomaly there? So, you know, in hindsight, it happened very quickly, but initially, he even would make comments like, you know, it was like pulling teeth to get a definitive statement out of me. He was very frustrated with me for a while.
How is history going to look at your friend, John Anthony West, in the future? How will he be remembered if this all comes out and there's a huge discovery and, I don't know, a machine is shown, something comes up that dates
this thing?
Yeah. What do you say?
Well, I think we have very, very good data now on the dating of the Sphinx. Robert Bovall and I discussed this in our book, Origins of the Sphinx. We now have, I'm digressing a little bit, but I'm going to come back to your comment. We now have not only hard geological dating that puts the Sphinx at a much earlier period. We have, of course, the archaeoastronomical data that Robert Bovall really was the principal developer of initially. That's why Robert Bovall, who I've also known for decades, decided to do a book together where we would combine the stars, as he says, and the stones on the ground. And that's Origins of the Sphinx. Since then, and I have it on my website, so if people want to go read it, and my website's www.robertschoch, and Schoch is spelled SCHOCH.com. Discovery has been made by Manu Saifzadeh, and he and myself and Robert Bovall wrote a paper about it that shows that there's hieroglyphic evidence that the Sphinx goes back prior to dynastic times, was originally a lion, which is something I had suspected all along because the head is recarved, that it's actually the lion Methet, which guards or, we'll say guards, protects a chamber or a hall of records, which Thomas DeBecky and I had found under the paw of the Sphinx, under the left paw of the Sphinx, which has yet to be explored. All of this, coming back to John Anthony West, was really initiated and instigated by John Anthony West. So in some ways, he's the grandfather or the founder of this role, this round of discovery. And something else I want to point out, because he and I had a chance to speak about this before his untimely death. Well, he was 85, but, he expected to live to be 120. And he died on...
Yeah.
Yeah, we always talked about this because there was so much to do. He was a generation older than me, but we expected him to live to be 120, or at least that's what he said he would do, certainly well into his 90s, not to die. It's only a few weeks now. He died on February 6, 2018.
Yeah.
But where was I going with this? He and I had the chance to talk about the bigger picture. Something that John Anthony West was very interested in was the concept of Atlantis. And this frustrated me no end when we first met and he was trying to get me involved, because at that point, Atlantis was a really bad word in academia. I literally refused to say the word Atlantis out loud for a number of years in the early 90s when we were working together. Now, I need to explain, because Atlantis ties in with this. Atlantis, as John Anthony West was talking about, was not a place. He didn't really care about, pinpointing where was Atlantis in terms of Plato's account. What he was most interested in, and I agree with him on this, and what I'm most interested in, is the dating of Atlantis. That is, in other terms, Atlantis is essentially a symbol, if you would, or code word for advanced civilization at a much earlier period than it's supposed to exist according to standard chronologies of archaeologists and prehistorians. Standard chronology is that civilization began about 5, maybe close to 6,000 years ago, if you stretch it a little bit. Plato talked about Atlantis collapsing in about 9600 BC, so we're talking about a discrepancy, that goes back, let's just say, 12,000 years rather than 6,000 years, putting civilization back thousands and thousands of years earlier. This was absolutely dismissed by the academics. What we're finding now is that, in fact, there is advanced culture, civilization going back to that early remote period, which in geological terms is prior to the end of the last ice age. The ice age ended in 9700 BC. I am now convinced that the Sphinx in its original form goes back to at least about 10,000 plus BC. The head has been recarved in dynastic times.
Mm-hmm.
We have Göbekli Tepe, and I talk about this on my website if people want to refer to it. I talk about, as you know, in Forgotten Civilization, Göbekli Tepe, this incredibly sophisticated site that goes back, the oldest portions go back again about 10,000 BC or earlier. And what I've established, and West was very excited about, John Anthony West was very excited about, is that I now believe we know what caused the demise of these earlier civilizations, including in Egypt, including in Turkey, and that was a major solar outburst, plasma flares, if you want to call it that, coronal mass ejections, that destroyed this early cycle of civilization. And then it reemerged in Egypt, which is what West and Schwaller had always been talking about, that there was an earlier civilization and Egypt was a legacy.
Let's talk for a minute about the Great Sphinx. Now, you've redated it, and I think you've changed your dating twice. Initially, it was 7,000 years. Now it's 10,500 BC, which would be around 12,000 years old. Are we any close to learning who carved the Sphinx, who the culture was? I mean, I've had you on with Robert Bovall once when we had this book come out, but the topic of who these people were is not discussed because there's no reference that I know about. But is there something new that we can bring out?
This is a real mystery, and you're absolutely right. When I was first involved in this, I was very hesitant. I pushed it back to, initially I was saying 5,000 to 7,000 BC, which is about as late as you can make the Sphinx based on the geology. But even then, frankly, my fellow geologists criticized me for that. I was being criticized both ways. The Egyptologist said it can't be older than 2,500 BC, more or less 4,500 years old. And my fellow geologists were telling me 5,000 to 7,000 BC, based on the data you have, it's probably older than that. I feel much more comfortable now with 10,000 to 11,000 BC in that range, which is Göbekli Tepe time, which is Zeptepi time. Astronomically, as Robert Bovall has really argued the case, and we talk about in Origins of the Sphinx, but we really do not. This is me speaking. I'm not convinced that we know who these people were, where they came from. What we see at the end of the last ice age, circa 10,000 BC, is really, in my assessment, a culmination. They were at a real height of sophistication, and they were devastated by these natural catastrophes and thrown into essentially a dark age. But there must have been, in my opinion, quite a bit of time leading up to that, you know, and we don't have that origins yet. I also want to point out that something that West, John Anthony West, was very interested in and kept insisting to me, and initially I thought it was absolutely crazy, and I thought it was less crazy as we put more evidence together, was sort of his more intuition, and he thought in many cases that perhaps civilization or some type of cycle of civilization, to use my term, went back maybe even a processional cycle earlier. So that would be another 26,000 years earlier, because some of the monuments you can date, or at least argue for dates precessionally, but it will have the same pattern, the same correlations with the stars a cycle earlier, if people understand about precession.
Precession of the equinox, yeah, exactly.
Yeah, so some of these sites could be, West used to argue, possibly be a precessional cycle earlier, or at least their origins, I should say, because we know that all of these sites, including the Sphinx, were used and reused, reappropriated, reused again. So with the Sphinx, the head was recarved, the so-called Sphinx and Valley temples. There's no question they were used in Old Kingdom dynastic times, but all the evidence now points to the fact that they were being reused, not built originally at that
I have to ask you, though, you've done a tremendous amount of travel. You've been to Easter Island. You've been to South America, Central America. Isn't there evidence of megalithic building that has similar quality than what you see in Egypt? Isn't there any correlation between some of these massive stoneworks that are in different parts of the world? I mean, Graham Hancock touches on it in his books, but I'm just curious from your perspective, do you see any kind of relationship in these megalithic builders at all that you can say, well, we're getting closer to understanding that maybe there was a blueprint that went around and there, you know, construction that's similar here, here, and here. What do you say about
that? Well, there's two aspects. One, there may have been blueprint and similar instructions, as you say. But what we really have is megalithic structures around the world at a very early time. And I'm fascinated by, for instance, the structures, as many people are, in Peru, Bolivia, Tiwanaku, and that whole complex comes to mind. Easter Island, I love. I've been there a number of times.
Pumapuku
is pretty fabulous. Although, you know, you don't have this large megalithic there in general, but that's a very, very ruinous site, should we say. And this gets to one of my points, is that, yes, we have this large megalithic structures around the world, which can be argued, and I would argue for at least some of them, that they go back to a much more remote period, much earlier period. But I also, and this is putting it all together, part of it may be similarities and worldwide connections, that type of thing. And I think based on the iconography, the architectural style, you have to argue that, or you can argue that. But the other thing is, and this gets back to my second point, is there was this huge solar outburst in my assessment based on putting all the evidence together at 9700 BC. It's recorded in ice cores. I'm now speaking as a geologist, and it's recorded very, very well that you had this incredible climatic change. You had a solar outburst. You had earthquake activity, volcanic activity at that time. And where I'm going with this is that one reason you have megalithic architecture surviving from that earlier period is because everything else was essentially destroyed. You know, in some cases incinerated, and we have vitrification around the world. We have petroglyphs that record what was going on. Getting back to John Anthony West, just because he's on my mind, he and I spoke in Norway, for instance. We did a conference, a two-man conference in Norway. One of the things I wanted to do if we were going to go do this conference was to see some of the petroglyphs in Norway that go back to the end of the last ice age, and sure enough, they confirmed what are known as... they confirmed what was happening at the end of the last ice age because people were recording what they saw in the sky. So there's two points I want to make, two aspects to it. One, yes, maybe similar, to use your term, blueprints or plans, and I have written about that long ago in the book Voyages of the Pyramid Builders, that yes, I'm convinced there was evidence of interchange of ideas, thoughts, communication around the world at a very early period. But the second thing is, similar things survived around the world because of the catastrophes that occurred.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk for a minute about your work with solar flares. Is it your understanding that the level of devastation that these flares created on the surface of the planet was such that entire populations were destroyed because of the radiation, or what was the cause of loss of life, would you say?
There was a lot of things going on. When you have a major solar flare, a major solar outburst like that, and we have not seen anything like that since, you know, that's in recorded history. We had a little teeny event, which was would be catastrophic for modern technology in 1859, the Carrington event. But when you have something the order of what occurred at the end of the last ice age, you would have major radiation levels on the surface of the Earth. And it doesn't take long to kill large mammals, and humans are large mammals. So, you probably had devastation of entire populations that couldn't escape. The way to escape is to essentially go into caves, to go underground, that type of thing. And this would have come in waves, so it wasn't just one boom and then nothing more. It's sort of like an earthquake and foreshocks and aftershocks. So you had radiation levels. I want to come back to that in a second. You had incredible earthquake activity. Papers are now putting this all together. When I say papers, geophysicists, which this used to be anathema. I mean, people couldn't talk about this. I mentioned it in Forgotten Civilization, that there are correlations between solar activity and earthquake activity. This used to be totally dismissed by mainstream scientists because there was, quote, no mechanism. But now there's very strong correlations. Mechanisms are being discovered as to how solar activity could affect earthquake activity through fluctuations of the geomagnetic field, and essentially electric currents in the Earth. Academic paper came out on that just within, I want to say, the last month or so by some geophysicists on it. And they're talking about modern time correlations. And if you extrapolate back to the end of the last ice age and what happened then with major solar outbursts, and earthquake activity would have been incredible on the surface of the Earth. At Göbekli Tepe, for instance, we see this where pillars were knocked down at that period, and they tried to hastily re-erect them. You would have had volcanic activity. You would have had you can think of like huge lightning bolts hitting the surface of the Earth, which would set fires to anything that's flammable. We have evidence of vitrification, surface vitrification of rock, where the rock was basically flash heated and melted and then recongealed. Some of the most famous examples of that are what are sometimes known as vitrified forts in Scotland, which classical archaeologists date to the Dark Ages, about 500 AD or so. In fact, there's lots of evidence that no, at least some of these, and there were probably smaller solar flares since then, but some of these go back to the end of the last ice age. They were just being reused at a later period, as many other ancient structures were being reused. You would have melted glaciers very, very quickly, virtually instantaneously, think of lightning bolts hitting water. It would have evaporated water, and I want to get to a quick point here. You would have had so much moisture in the atmosphere, in many areas, that it would have come down again as torrential rain. So we have evidence of flooding, and every country in the world, every continent in the world, indigenous people have very similar stories of things happening in the sky and flooding, that type of thing.
Is this the basis for the biblical flood, would you say?
Oh, I think it is. I think it is.
Okay, well, that
I think
was a
it
question.
Is.
Okay.
Yeah, I think it is. And it's some people think it's ironic, but solar outbursts will cause massive torrential rains and flooding, as well as incineration. It depends on what's hitting where and what is on the surface at that point. Getting back to your point about radiation, one way to escape is underground. So we have, and it's perplexed archaeologists, classical archaeologists, but they have pointed out that 9,700 years ago, at the end of the last ice age, we find people going into caves. We find them actually expanding natural caves. We have them developing essentially underground cities. So you have something like Cappadocia in Turkey, which I think its origins go back to this early period. Now, this classical archaeologist will tell you, it's all Roman or Byzantine or maybe Hittite, more or less in the last few thousand years. These cities. Some of them could hold tens of thousands of people. They found them, these underground cities. I will say, as a geologist, the classical explanations make no sense whatsoever.
Oh,
if they were that recent, you would have spoil heaps on the surface. They wouldn't have eroded away by now. You know,
so those underground caverns are curious, and there's somewhat sophisticated. I guess the question I would have is, and I can see why the orthodoxy is kind of questioning the dates on some of those underground caverns, is how would they know if these flares are coming up? I guess started building, hoping that they could avoid a second flare. Is what you're suggesting?
Exactly. And I started by saying that I'm convinced now that you had the major one that ended the last ice age, but you had, we'll call it, like sort of equivalent of aftershocks that came again.
Mm-hmm.
And so for a while they were expecting more, so they were building these. Not unlike, here's a crude analogy, in maybe the 50s or so, when in America everyone expected we would have a nuclear attack from the Soviet Union, and people were building underground bunkers. But in this case, they'd already had the attack from the sun, and they were preparing again. But also you have to realize that in Cappadocia, for instance, the rock it congeals and hardens once you've cut it and it's exposed to air, but it's a perfect situation to be able to carve these types of things. On Easter Island, you have a different situation. You have natural lava tubes that formed naturally, and when we've been there, Katie, my wife, and I have been there. For instance, one time someone just told us out of the blue about how the legends were that the people had to live in those because of, you know, the tumultuous things going on the surface.
Yeah,
yeah. And so there you had a natural caves that people could go into. And on Easter Island, when I take people there, I show them how you go into these caves, but you can also see how they modified them for living. So they built sort of benches along the side. They would, in some cases, enclose the natural entrance to make it very, very small so that, you know, radiation, et cetera, won't leak in.
Mm-hmm.
And the best way to protect yourself to this day, if this happens again, and it will happen again, I'm not trying to be a fearmonger, I'm just speaking as a geologist and having studied the astrophysics of it, our star is a normal star. Stars do these things periodically. The best way to protect oneself is to go into caves, whether natural or artificial, to go underground, because the rock gives protection.
So let me ask you quickly, you're talking about Easter Island. Did you find that the people there were contemporaries to pre-dynastic Egypt, or are they later?
The classic, okay, I have to answer it. It's not a short answer. Well, a moderate answer. The classic view, no, you have to put it in context. The classic view is that Easter Island was settled very, very late, only by Polynesians. When I say very late, some archaeologists say 500 AD, some say 1200 AD, which on both accounts I think are a bit ridiculous looking at the data, because there's plenty of data, I believe, that suggests that the earliest habitation of Easter Island goes back to a much, you know, more remote period. Yes, contemporaneous with ancient Egypt, et cetera. And I won't be surprised.
Oh, really?
In fact, I'm expecting that when all is said and done, we're going to find that Easter Island was colonized or inhabited at various periods going back, you know, to this really remote period. This ties in with something else. Whenever you want to try to claim that the first people were on Easter Island, that doesn't affect what I believe we're establishing as a good fact now, that they carried on traditions going back at least 12,000 years or so. So, for instance, they have what is known as the Rongo-Rongo script. It goes back, well, let me back up. It's a hieroglyphic type script. It reminds many people of Egyptian hieroglyphics. It is unique to the Pacific region. They're the only, quote, Polynesians, unquote, that had a script, that developed a script. It's carved into wooden tablets, which were very precious at the time. what we have today are only about two dozen, maybe 26 of these tablets left in various museums around the world. They've been undeciphered by the conventional archaeologists and linguists, and I'm of the belief, and this is something that my wife and I, Katie, have been developing, that no, these actually tie in with petroglyphs going back to the end of the last ice age, recording what happened at that time in terms of solar outbursts. And this ties in with the work of, for instance, Dr. Anthony Perrott, a plasma physicist at Los Alamos, who has been working on these types of things too, independently and confirmatory, confirmatory of each other. So some of the archaeologists will say, oh, you know, a couple of those Easter Island, and I was going to say, we've received confirmation from that team that, that the petroglyphs and the Rongo Rongo, it all ties together. It goes back to these plasma outbursts. And what I was about to say is some of the archaeologists will say, oh, you know, one of the tablets was carbon dated and it only goes back 100 or 200 years. You know, it's not ancient. Well, that doesn't matter. If you use the same logic, then you would dismiss half of Plato's writings, or maybe all of Plato's writings, because we don't have original manuscripts going back, to the time of Plato or the Bible. And my point is that even the Easter Islanders tradition is that these were sacred, if you would, more or less very special, important, and they copied them. So what we have passed down, of course, like oral traditions, but in this case written, is copies of copies of copies, and they very meticulously copied them. And unfortunately, Easter Island was devastated during the 19th century with slave raids and that type of thing. And a lot of the oral traditions were lost. But when they did ask them in the 19th century what these tablets meant or what they were about, the best answer they got is that the people at that time said they really couldn't, quote, decipher them or read them, but they point it to the sky. That has something to do with things in the sky.
Fascinating. I want to come back to the Sphinx, I think I've asked you this before, but I'm always curious about your perception. You've shown with great clarity, and you've had the endorsement of your peers, that the body of the Sphinx was weathered via water.
Absolutely.
And the situation with the Egyptological Society is that they don't seem to care about the geological age of the stone that is carved into a Sphinx. When are they going to come to grips with this data? And if not, what does that say about this group of professionals? I mean, I don't want to name names like Hawass
or Mark Lehner.
Mark Lehner. But what, I mean, from your profession and that of your peers, when I thought that science is all about working with others, group.
Yeah, but you're making, I won't be too nasty here, but I'll say this somewhat jokingly. You're making a couple of assumptions.
Okay.
You're assuming that science is objective. You're assuming that Egyptologists are scientists, perhaps.
Mm-hmm.
They're not. And frankly, science is supposed to be objective, but the people that pursue science or any other academic discipline, they're real people and they have their own subjective perceptions, they have their own biases, and their own biases tend to be that they support what they've stuck their neck out or what they've made their career on all these years. So if you think about logically, someone who wrote their PhD on the Sphinx and published heavily that it was 2500 BC built under the orders of the Pharaoh Khafre, I'm referring to Mark Lehner at the moment, who also went to Yale, but was in Egyptology, he probably doesn't appreciate, I know he doesn't appreciate me saying he's basically wrong in something he's advocated all this time. People don't want to change their view. But all that being said, so there's a lot of psychological type things and vested interest is really what I'm saying.
And does it have to be for a younger generation? Does a younger generation have to come in and go, look, We're looking at this data and saying we believe it's true. Is that usually how it changes?
In many cases, in the academic disciplines, whether it's science or some other academic discipline, and what I was saying is that Egyptology is not really science. And I'm not saying that in a nasty way, but it's more like art history and humanities and that type of thing. They might use scientific methods, but this is not a joke. When I was at Yale as a graduate student in geology and geophysics, I remember distinctly in hindsight, because I wasn't involved in Egypt at that time, that one of the documents we read, one of the reading assignments, was this paper, very long paper, on how difficult it is to get Egyptologists specifically to accept scientific data, because they basically didn't understand it. They come from a different background traditionally, et cetera, et cetera. Little did I realize that within 10 years, I would be dealing with that personally with Egyptologists who were resistant to scientific data. And now going back to the 1990s, I remember being at Egyptological meetings and conferences presenting my data, and Egyptologists coming up to me and saying, and I'm paraphrasing now, that we don't understand what you're talking about. We don't understand the science. I even would show them sometimes, some of my raw data. They had no clue what they were looking at. The story sometimes tell, which is true, is that at one point, one guy, he's looking at it and he can't make any sense of it. I say, well, maybe you should turn it this way. He was looking at it upside down and didn't even realize it. That's how clueless he was.
Oh, my God.
I know. But I would have them say to me, and one very senior Egyptologist in particular at one point said to me, look, I don't understand your data. I don't know any geology. All I know is that you're wrong. And
oh,
it was just very, very dogmatic.
But these are the people who are writing the history of Egypt. And,
I know. But most people, how many people can read hieroglyphics? How many people know enough geology? Well, maybe they do now because I've been trying to popularize it and explain it. It's pretty simple once you explain it. But you can pull the wool over people's eyes if they're not specialists in many cases.
Yeah. Wow.
So I'm being a little crude, but I think it has to do with these types of things. I want to get one other thought out, which just came to me. Something is that's not just personal vested interest, but it's vested interest in a certain view of the world. And that view is, and this gets back to John Anthony West, is that we have only gotten bigger and better and more technologically sophisticated, and we're so much better than the ancients. And to say that, no, some of this stuff goes really far back, and there were really sophisticated people at a much earlier time than was ever imagined by conventional archaeologists, suggests that maybe we're not the height of civilization. I have met so many classical Egyptologists that when it comes right down to it, I can only think that they study ancient Egypt simply to make fun of it and feel good about how much smarter they are than the stupid old ancient Egyptians who believed in all these silly gods and made some pretty temples, but that was about it.
Wow. You know, that kind of takes me to my next question of you. The particle physics that are involved with this Japanese-French scientific team that scanned the Cheops Pyramid, and I read that there was a tremendous amount of resistance from the Egyptological society groups, and I found that quite odd that they wouldn't want to know what's inside of it. What do we know about this discovery?
Example. This is a great independent example. What they did to me and what they continue to do to me regarding my geological data and scientific data, here you have a totally independent group of people, primarily physicists, particle physicists, as you mentioned, and the Egyptologists are doing exactly the same thing to them. The ministry, the classic Egyptologists led by people like Hawass and Lehner, same two people that I had to deal with all these decades, they are saying that this is all nonsense. Oh, we knew it all along. There are no voids, or if there are voids, they're just little voids and, you know, little chinks of voids, you know, little cavities between the rocks, because the rocks weren't put together real carefully because no one's in there. They're denying everything. The ministry has actually called this propaganda. Oh, it's propaganda.
I heard
it's sort
that.
Of the quote.
Yeah.
Egyptological, I hate to bring in modern, but it's sort of the Egyptological equivalent of the present presidential administration when they say things are fake news. You know, is it seriously? I mean,
I've
looked at the raw data from that study. I've read the Nature article that they published. I mean, this is really good data. And there is no doubt there is a big void, a big cavity there. And the Egyptologists are kicking and screaming that, no, it can't be, you know, misinterpreted. This is all propaganda. So substitute the term fake news. This is all fake science.
Right.
Or fake news. They called me a pseudoscientist. They're essentially doing the same thing to these guys.
Wow.
And, of course,
they have no
clue what they're looking at. They don't understand the data, and that only frustrates them more.
Yeah, what do we know about this the scan? And I know that I read probably a couple of months ago that they had developed a unique drone that was going to be passed into this void. Do we have any updates on any of that?
I don't know. In fact, I worry that the ministry and the you know, the council in Egypt is going to shut the whole thing down, as I've experienced too. I mean, the data is real. It looks to be that there's a huge cavity as big as the Grand Gallery, approximately in that size range. But in the pyramid above the Grand Gallery, it could be horizontal, it could be angled. I personally think the best thing to do is to do a little more physics on it to try to, you know, get really tight parameters on it and exactly where it is, and then it would make sense to try to probe into it. I mean, you can drill into it and put a camera in there, you know, with modern technology. That's what they did with the little doors that were in the air shafts, also known as star shafts.
Right.
And then they found another door behind that. They also have been doing drones, as you mentioned. I think you're talking about the flying drones, where you can collect data above thermal data, thermal imaging data, that type of thing, to, again, try to define as rigorously as possible exactly where it is, so that if you do get to the point where you're allowed to drill or try to probe it physically, you're not going to miss it.
I'm just curious about
the authorities have been really resistant. The Egyptologists have been really resistant.
Yeah, there was a. I mean, it was serious science, and they paid a great deal of money to get inside there and put these scanning tools together. And
this is
serious
science, high technology. This is, you know, multi. I have no clue what it costs them, but, you know, we're talking, what, probably tens of millions.
Yeah, that's serious.
When all said and done with the crews and the data and what you have to pay in Egypt, et cetera, et cetera. And then for the Egyptologist, one guy, and I know him, I'm not going to mention names. I'm not going to mention other names, but I know him personally. He's with the he's an Egyptologist in Egypt, and I was so astounded and embarrassed, frankly, when I saw on that he was publicly saying that this mission, as they call it the missions, this mission of the physicists should be shut down immediately. You know, it's all propaganda. It should be shut down immediately. They should never be allowed back in Egypt. I mean, what kind of reaction is that? It's not it's not a scientific reaction. It's not even a open academia reaction. It's basically some kind of weird paranoia that they might discover something that the Egyptologists missed and that that irks the Egyptologist, or they might discover something that makes Egyptologists have to rewrite their books.
That's what I'm thinking. I think they're worried.
I think they're worried. No, they're absolutely worried.
You know?
And you know, they might discover something, and I think this ties back with the Sphinx and my work and what John Anthony West first got everyone thinking about, is that maybe our basic conventional story of the timeline of civilization and from dumb to smart is not correct, that it's a little more complicated than that, and it goes back much further.
Yeah. You know, in your most recent book with Robert Bovall, Origins of the Sphinx, you guys actually write in the conclusion, the epilogue, that you believe that Zeptepi, Zep meaning time, Tepi meaning first people,
mm-hmm.
is an actual period. And you highlighted the beginning of the show with that. But when you say Zeptepi, that's an Egyptian focused term. Is there other civilizations like Göbekli Tepe or any place else that you've noticed that has kind of a starting period? Or we think, and you can correct me if I'm wrong on this, that Göbekli Tepe was kind of a small little learning center in some way.
What learning center?
A learning center. Wasn't it a learning center where they...
Yeah, I think it was a learning center. I think it was sort of like the best analogy might be a university today.
Yeah, yeah.
Learning center, museum, university, center of... knowledge, that type of thing. I don't think it was a temple. When people say temple, that has a modern connotation, which I don't think applies to it. And this ties in with something else that Schwaller used the term in English, translated sacred science, more or less that there wasn't the distinction between science and religion and spirituality in ancient times that we have today. And I think this ties in, too, with the concept of a first time or Zeptepi. You see this actually through around the world, I believe, in the concept of usually people think of it as a golden age. A golden age, and civilizations around the world, cultures around the world have, and I use the term myth with due respect, not as just something that's nonsensical, but they have myths and traditions of a golden age. You see that in the Yuga cycle. You see among the Maya. You see that, you know, Australian Aborigines. You see that in classical Greek and Greece and Rome. You see that in Egypt. You see it in Peruvian legends, et cetera, et cetera, that there was a time and that Atlantis is essentially the same thing, that there was this earlier period of incredible sophistication and then followed by a catastrophe. And that's essentially what the Egyptians were talking about is Zeptepi. So that's just one term for something that I think is quite universal.
I want to ask you a question that I'm sure you can answer this, but I was surprised to learn from Christopher Dunn, who we had on the show about a month ago, that he believes that many of the Ramsey II, all of the Ramsey II sculptures that he studied were repurposed, meaning that they were extremely old, and then people like Ramsey II and some of the earlier pharaohs actually put their cartouches on these. And this is something that I guess was a practice of these dynastic pharaohs, is to make them their own. What do you say about
they,
that?
They were reusing. I agree with the general sentiment and assessment. I mean, you said all of the Ramesses too. I will not claim to have taken inventory of all of them.
Well, I'm talking. I should rephrase.
I know what you're saying.
The ones that are at the Luxor Luxor.
Say it again.
Well, the ones
Luxor, for instance. You go to Luxor, the Temple of Luxor, and people should come with me. I'm actually trying to, if I could put a little plug in here, I'm putting together a trip to Egypt right now, probably for late May 2019. And I We'll put a little plug in, backwards plug here, back in time. I actually did John Anthony West's last Egypt trip because he was too sick with the cancer to lead it himself, so I led it in his place. But something that I point out at this now on trips, and he and I were both very interested in, is exactly what you're talking about, and that Christopher Dunn has, of course, done a lot of work on, that a lot of these statues were, as you said, repurposed. I would say, you know, another way to say is reappropriated. They went back to a much earlier time, and these guys just came and they chiseled their names on them and used them. And I can point out on site to people where you can see, and it doesn't take much to see it once it's pointed out, that the names are chiseled in secondarily. They cover over earlier structures, etc. They're not exactly where you'd want to place them if the statue had been carved originally with the intention of having that name on it. In the museum in Cairo, you can find statues that were reused several times by different pharaohs. And there's no doubt in my mind at this point that some of these go back to well before dynastic times, probably, you know, and they were reusing things. And then we come back to my favorite, the biggest statue of all, the Sphinx, which was being reused and reappropriated during dynastic times, and as you say, repurposed. So yeah, I'm in complete agreement with that. The data, and this ties in again with the bigger picture that we're now reconstructing of an earlier civilization, and as West would say, dynastic Egypt was built on that legacy.
Okay. Final question for you. Graham Hancock was just with us a couple weeks ago, and he's writing a new book on the Americas and this devastating, what he believes was an asteroid hit that basically caused a tremendous amount of upheaval, including tsunamis and other damage. Is there a link to what he believes in terms of an asteroid hit and your solar flares that kind of ties it together, or are you do you object to his thoughts on an asteroid series of asteroids hitting the Americas and in the Atlantic and causing devastation?
No, I think he's basically wrong. Yeah. I mean, I'll be blunt.
Tell him to stop the presses.
Well, you know how I feel. There's a couple of things going on here. What he's talking about, he's basing it on, and I know the geologists involved, and they've been pushing at this and trying to gain evidence for it for a long time, that there was a comet, or you're using the term asteroid, some kind of bolide that hit over North America or maybe fragmented. That's at the beginning of the Younger Dryas, when you have a cooling period in approximately 10,900, 10,800 BC. And then what I'm talking about is the end of the last ice age at 9,700 BC. Now, the problem is, I'll make this brief, the problem is that there's no good evidence for any kind of physical bolide, comet, asteroid, that type of thing. There's all this stuff about, not to get into real technical terms, but nano diamonds and fractured stress
quartz. Yeah, and the Carolina Lakes and things and all that.
What?
I mean, weren't the Carolinas?
Yeah, there's the Carolina base. The problem is a lot of this is not synchronous. Spread over thousands and thousands of years. These are not, you know, if you're going to invoke something like a comet or asteroid hitting, it hits, and all this stuff should line up time-wise. It frankly doesn't. And a lot of the data, too, for instance, it's now been demonstrated that some of these, quote, markers that people always thought had to be from a bolide, a comet or asteroid or meteorite, they can form from lightning strikes too. And if you have a major solar outburst, you've essentially got huge lightning strikes that can cause fields of these. And so people wonder, well, why are there no craters, proper craters, et cetera, and
right.
fragments of meteoritic material? Well, you're not going to get that if it's a solar event. So, you
okay.
know, there's, and he invokes a lot of stuff. I just disagree with it geologically. There's
gotcha.
It's an interesting thing, but there's other things happening.
Robert, this has been fun. I really appreciate the time. Why don't you let us know? Okay, you gave us the link to your website. But
yeah.
What's coming up for you? You got another book in the works? I know.
Yeah, I'm always working on books. I'm working
yeah.
on things. If people would like to travel, I'll be posting things on the website. Actually, I'm going to be. I'm taking a group. And this ties in, of course, with the megalithic sites to Ireland. So we're going to Ireland. There's still time to sign up for that if people are interested. That's in June of this year. As I said,
okay.
I'll be putting together a trip for – I'm working on putting together a trip for May of 2019 to Egypt. I'm also putting together – it's still in the works, but we'll be posted on the website when it's all together, a trip to
okay.
Easter Island, for instance. So people, if they're interested in traveling and seeing some of these sites, which is the best way to learn about it, check out my website, and that's www.robertschoch.com, and Schoch is spelled S-C-H-O-C-H.
Fantastic. I'll post it on the Facebook page.
Wonderful.
Today. Hey, Robert, thank you. I appreciate it. Have a wonderful year. By the way, are you going to be doing Contact in the Desert in California this summer? Are you going to be out there?
Not to my knowledge. They haven't.
Okay.
No one's contacted me about Contact.
okay.
Maybe they will. If the people want me there, they should tell the
yeah.
organizers to invite me.
Yeah. Okay. Well, we'll see. We'll see what's going on. All right.
Yeah.
Hey, again, thanks for joining us, and always fun.
Okay. Sounds great. So check out my website. I was going to say there's a Croatia cruise too, but yeah.
Oh,
and
Jesus. Man.
Check
Good.
Everything out, and yeah, it's been a pleasure being on the show.
Always fun. All right, we'll
okay.
be in touch.
Okay, take care.
Okay, I hope you liked that. He is a lot of fun to speak with, and I would remind you, if you ever get a chance to go on one of his tours, or if you have a chance to see him in person at one of his presentations, his slides are phenomenal. He has not only current slides, because he does a lot of traveling, but he has done research and found some of the early photographs, imagery of a lot of the ancient structures like the Sphinx that you can check out. So very, very good. Thanks to Robert Schoch today. Also, thanks to my team, LeGrand Green, Mark Foster, Curtis Hartong, and all the others who contribute. Remember, your support, your sponsorship, your donation as a patron of Earth Ancients is appreciated. And all we ask is that you provide a monthly bit of cash, $3 if that's all you can afford. $10 is the best because you get access to the newsletter. You get a recording that is not featured on the program, a private recording of a guest that I did not post. And you get other options. So for more information, go to Patreon. That's patreon.com/Earth Ancients and donate. Your donation is what keeps us going. Next week, it's all about ancient America. My guest will be Frank Joseph from Ancient America Magazine. Frank is one of the foremost authorities and really, really a great interview. He has a new book on ancient America that we will talk about. All right, that's it. Have a great week, and we will talk to you next time.